my motto is dare to dream. Dare is the big word. You have to take risks. Mm-hmm. You know, you do all you can to prepare, to train, to cover all your ground. There will come a time you have to execute. And I have failed many times. People know, you know, it's in the newspaper and all that. But it's part of the learning journey. There's nothing to hide. Mm-hmm. You know, that transparency, being genuine. And that's how you garner trust. Mm-hmm. Right? If you're not genuine, people will not trust you. When sponsors see this is Mr. Koo, he's going to do what he says. And if he doesn't succeed, he'll come back alive and try again.
Yeah.
That to me is very precious, that commercial trust.
Hey Stevies, welcome to episode 143 of the So This My Why podcast. I'm your host and producer, Lin Ya, and today's guest is Koo Swee Chiao. If you're from Singapore or around the region, you might know his name, especially if you love adventure, because he is Singapore's first professional adventurer. He started out in IT, and one day he was in a plane, he looked down and he saw Everest and he thought, I want to climb it. And so he did. He trained for 10 years, and in 1998, he was part of Singapore's first successful expedition up to the summit of Everest. At the end of it, obviously, there was a lot of interest from the media and he thought, oh, I need to write on it. So he arranged another trip, and the following year, he went to the Antarctica. And from there, he thought, maybe I should give this a go. Since that first expedition, he's done Everest three times. Another time in 2006, 2011, he's also skied from South to North Pole. He cycled from Singapore to Beijing in 2003, which is 8,000 kilometers. He swam 40 kilometers across the Malacca Straits, kayaks across the Philippines, which is 3,000 kilometers, rollerbladed 6,000 kilometers from Hanoi to Singapore, has broken two Guinness World Records, including being underwater for 220 hours, climbed K2, which is honestly a lot more dangerous and harder than Everest, in 2012, and completed his 200th peak in 2019. And guess what? He's now age 58 and still going strong. So if you're curious as to why someone like this made such a huge pivot, how does one make a career out of it? How do you deal with things like death? Because he has had many friends who are very, very good mountaineers who died as well. How do you combat things like the fact that hikers, adventurers are very selfish? All you want to go is for self-glorification, but consider the geopolitics of those regions. And also for people who want to do exactly what he's done. What's his advice for all of them? If you're interested, just stay tuned because we're going to dive deep. And before we get into this episode, just to let you know, there is a YouTube version of this episode. So if you want to see this studio in all its glory, just head over to YouTube and look for So This Moai. And if you're in Singapore and also want a studio, just look out for Linpei Studios. The website is headmail.com/Linpei Studios. It's also in the show notes, so you can find out more as well. So are you ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the So This Is My Why podcast, where we talk to people about their whys and how they turn them into realities to inspire you to live your best life. And here's your host, Ling Ya.
You were born in Port Dickson.
Yeah.
And you have a sister who got really frustrated with you because you always ask why. What were you like as a kid?
Yeah, I'm a kampung boy, you know, PD boy, and I have five elder brothers. So by the time I grew up, there's a big age gap. They've all gone to work and all that. So I'm pretty much alone, playing just with one or two friends. I'm always curious since young, asking lots of questions, and, you know, my sister got so fed up with me. I guess that turned into the drive to climb mountain later on.
Yeah. But when you were young, you hiked Gunung Ledang, or never again, you have a
Yes, that was fast forward to high school, after, I believe, Form 3, a bunch of us went to Gunung Ledang. Yeah, I remember I was so scared. That was my first big adventure. It was quite steep, and at that time, there was no ladders, very few. So you're really climbing that mountain as it is, very steep, and then we spent a night up there. And after coming home, I promised to myself, I will never climb a mountain again.
I mean, to be fair, I've climbed some of these mountains in Malaysia. They're not safe.
Things can happen.
Things can really happen. You just need to fall to the side a little bit. And that's it.
But that trip was quite interesting. But after that, I didn't climb for many years.
Yeah. And then you end up doing computer science.
Yes. Yeah. That's also interesting because I didn't know what I wanted to do in life.
Yeah.
I picked computer science because people say, hey, you know, it's a good future, blah, blah, blah. So I said, why not? And so I ended up doing computer science.
You went to Kansas.
That was after I graduated. I was what they call working in Abacus. Yeah, Abacus is a consortium of a travel agency kind of reservation system set up by MAS, Singapore Airlines, and so forth. So yeah, they sent me to Kansas City of all places. It's a very flat place, no mountains. But that was the beginning of my journey because I went to the Rockies and loved it. Then I started trekking. I was so crazy. I remember I would Friday night drive like 600 miles to Colorado, sleep for a while, and then climb one or two mountains, and then Sunday night drive back, and Monday go back to work. It's like, wow.
Good to be young.
Yeah, but that was the beginning of my so-called mountain journey. Yeah.
And then you saw Everest from a plane.
Yeah, and then I got a job in Singapore. I went to Nepal for the first time, and again, I was not a climber, just went with friends. We wanted to go to Everest Base Camp. We didn't go, the weather was so bad, we couldn't go. So we ended up in Poon Hill. And then on the way back, I saw Everest on the plane. I still remember that black pyramid and that etch in my mind. It's like, wow, you know, that piece of rock.
I want to get to it.
Yeah, the highest on the earth. And I came home very excited, very scared as well, not knowing how to do it. So I started reading a lot of books, and then I went to New Zealand to do my so-called basic mountaineering course.
But it didn't turn out well, so you didn't give up?
Yeah, it was too tough for me at the time. I wasn't good in technical stuff and so forth. The instructor was very strict.
What kept you going if it was already so tough?
So what happened was I kind of stopped for a while.
Yeah.
I came back, and then I thought maybe Everest wasn't for me.
Yeah.
But I didn't give up, and I went to climb Kilimanjaro.
Okay.
And I got to the top, and then that dream was like alive again. You know, so from then on, I started pursuing it very actively.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, right? If people haven't gone to mountains, they don't understand there is something about it that's magical.
Yeah.
And you come back, you're almost on a high.
Yeah. Yeah, what can I say? It's you know, mountain is magical, it's spiritual, it's you know, very personal kind of a feeling and encounter.
Can you elaborate a bit more about the spiritual for those who haven't been on the mountain? They'll be like, you're crazy, man.
Yeah, I used to spend a lot of time in the church. There was even one point in time I thought God called me to be a pastor. Then I started going to the mountain and I saw something very differently. And if you can say I found God in the mountain.
Awesome.
That connection, that clarity, that because quietness, you know, that peace.
Is it because every day it's really just you and the mountains?
It's just me and the mountain. It's like there's a communion going on. Yeah, and you could appreciate the beauty, you could appreciate that mountain was talking to me. And since then, I know, yeah, I found my calling. I found my second home. Yeah, then I stopped going to church.
But yeah, 10 years to prepare for that trip, that's a long time to keep it alive.
It's a long time, and I believe it was necessary. People say you need 10 years to be a master of something. Mm. And I believe that 10 years gave me a very good foundation, and it also gave me a very sound risk assessment. To put it in a nutshell, it's better to be alive.
So
knowing when to turn back is so crucial.
You learned that during those times?
I learned that a lot.
And
I got lost many times in the mountains, you know, sometimes with friends, sometimes alone. Those experiences taught me to be very careful, to plan it even more properly, and to know when to turn back. So I have a list of mountains which I climbed, which I attempted, which I haven't got to the top. And it's okay, you know, every trip is a learning point.
Was it tough for you to get to that point where you say it's okay to not let my ego take the forefront?
It took a while. When I first started, it was like I have to get to the top, you know. I spent so much money, so much time and all that, I want to get to the top. And there were times like that when I started. And then slowly you learn. The mountain kind of speaks to you and you learn to appreciate every step of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is a lot more than the summit.
What were some of the big hikes you did in those 10 years leading up to Everest?
Well, Kilimanjaro was a big one.
Yeah.
And then I went to Nepal again a few times before the Everest team came on. There was one trip, again, I was so ambitious, I paid permit for like two or three peaks.
Wow.
And I climbed none of it.
Oh my.
Yeah, I got so sick.
AMS.
A very humbling experience.
Yeah.
And in those early years, I wasn't sure what to do. You know, no knowledge of AMS, don't know what is HAPE, I don't know what is HACE, you know, vomit all over, headache, yeah.
How did it
was,
you?
It was learning, yeah, it's just learning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't pleasant at the time, but as I read up more, as I get to know my body more,
yeah,
that helps.
So what's the trick to get better with AMS?
Go slow, very simple, don't rush it. And that is so true in maddening pace, our modern society pace. Most of us don't have enough time, don't have enough leave, but we still want to get to that point. So these days, having done guiding for so many years, I tell people, if you don't have time, do a smaller mountain. Yeah, never take the shortcut, because that can cost your life.
I remember when I was doing Everest Base Camp,
yeah.
There was this person who's a local from Dingboche, and I bumped into him as I was hiking from Namche. And I was like, hang on, where are you coming from? He has this large Greenwich sat with him. He said, I make this trip every single week. This is my week's supply for my family.
Wow.
I'm hiking from Namche to Dingboche this afternoon. And I went, Dingboche is 2 days away from us.
Yeah, right.
But for him, he was taking it very slow, very steady. That's the thing I noticed about every local there. They grew up on the mountains, but it's slow and steady no matter what. You don't run.
That is the mountain pace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the most incredible thing. And then one of the things you mentioned, obviously, cost is a huge factor.
Yeah.
I learned as you were preparing the Singapore trip to Everest as well, you got the support of the late Ong Teng Cheong. I wonder how that came to be.
Yeah, we owe President Ong Teng Cheong a big one. He was the one that believed in us, you know, and believed in our cause, trying to climb Mount Everest, you know, as the first Singapore team. He gave us a lot of support. He gave us an endorsement letter, which is very important. At the time, I was in Singapore Airlines. So with that letter, he opened doors. Yeah, not just sponsorship, but in terms of support from my immediate boss, for example, from my department, my colleagues. I have to kind of, you know, buy in everybody.
Yeah.
And then we met him personally as well, Ong Teng Cheong.
Yeah.
He hosted us in the Istana and talked to us. At the time, it was the president's charity. Yeah, and he raised a lot of money for us as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What was the thing that you think he allowed him to say, yes, I'll support you? Because it's not like you had done huge, huge peaks before.
Well, he, I guess, believed in the courage to try.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there has to be the first team, right, to do it.
You were told when you can't fail.
Ah, yes. I remember at the farewell at Istana, he said to us very sternly, get it right the first time. He was like, wow, kind of pressure. And as you know, we got it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we didn't submit the first attempt due to many reasons.
Yeah.
But we didn't give up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't 1 week later, we got it.
But by then, you must have been exhausted.
Yeah. Yeah. The second attempt, there was not that joy anymore.
Mm.
It was somebody had to do it for the country.
Yeah. And two of you did.
Yeah. Yeah. Climbing Everest once is tiring enough because we got up to the South Summit, which is very high.
Yeah.
And then you climb it again 1 week later, it's like, wow. You know, you hardly recovered.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we were hard-pressed, but we got it done.
What is something you wish people knew about climbing Everest?
Okay, so these days is so different, the scenario. Right? I'm sure you've read a lot
so commercialized.
About the news. Yeah, so commercialized, so crowded.
Yes.
When we climbed it first time in 98, the crowd was there, but it's very different.
Traffic
not so many
jam.
People. There was traffic jam, but it's not so bad.
Okay.
Yeah. And we know most of the people, most of the teams in the base camp. You know, we make friends with the Iranians, British Americans. Yeah. So it's like a little family.
Yeah.
Now, the base camp is like a huge city. It'll take you 1 hour to walk from one end to another.
Wow.
Yeah. It's that big.
That is huge.
So there's no longer that community feeling. And yeah, it's just too crowded. And then you have so many issues coming up.
You think that's a shame? Because on one hand, it's great people love this so much more. Another is that original feeling's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people of my generation who climb Everest will always regret it's turned up to be this way now.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just for those who have never done it or research into it, you do spend a long time in that base camp.
Yeah, a long time. Reason is the logistics, you know, the Sherpas need to set up Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, Camp 4.
Mm-hmm.
The route has to be open to the summit and so forth. So you are waiting for all that to happen.
Yeah.
And then you yourself will have to go up to Camp 2, maybe Camp 3, at least once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then acclimatize, come back down, go up again.
Yeah. Yeah. But all in all, there are very few climbing days. If you look at the whole, like, 6 weeks, most of the time you're waiting. That's Everest.
Yeah.
That is with all the 8,000 meter peaks, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Everest all you dreamt it would be?
First time?
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, first time, yeah. It's more than what I expected.
How
I mean, because of the first failed attempt, and then the second time was hard. But I remember standing on the summit, looking at the horizon, that view you will never, never forget. On the horizon, you could see Makalu, you could see Kanchenjunga, and then you turn around, you could see Shoyu and Shisha Pengma. It's like, wow.
I want to conquer you.
Yeah. No, it's like, man, you know, you're in heaven.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. You know? And then you came back.
It's like, when I came back from the first trip, it's like I saw a new horizon, literally and symbolically. And I knew I want to do this for the rest of my life. I did not know how or what kind of form it would take, but I know I want to dedicate my time wholeheartedly. Of course, the idea of quitting my job came, but I needed some time to test it out.
Yeah.
And that is why after Everest, I did the South Pole quickly.
Because
I
knew, year.
Yeah, that was, you know, no rest.
Yeah, and it's a totally different skill set.
Yeah, different skills. And I love it because I have to unlearn and learn new skills. But what happened is the year 2000, I took 1 year no pay leave to kind of test it out. And I finished my 7 summits and I was lucky to find sponsors to do all that.
Yeah.
At the end of that year, that was when things confirmed to me that, I'm going to do this.
But just before that, right, going back to Antarctica, because I think that's so interesting. You said before, every day looked exactly the same.
Yeah, that trip was another epic adventure. I knew the media high will not last forever. I knew now is the time to do it, even though it's another big one.
Yeah.
Right? But if you don't do it now, you won't get the chance.
Mm.
So I quickly organized the team. At the time was Goh Chok Tong, our Prime Minister, lend us support.
Why not? Yeah, President.
Yeah, and he did, which was very nice, to quickly launch the Antarctica expedition.
Mm.
We only took 1 year to train. And that was like a leapfrog learning because I took 10 years to learn how to climb Everest. So we went to Greenland, we went to New Zealand to learn from the best, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot to talk about in that learning process. But I just want to say that you need to take risks to achieve something that you think you cannot achieve.
So it wasn't so much the mountains that drew you. It's more the pushing yourself to the very edge physically.
Yeah.
Exciting.
And that was pushing myself in all ways, you know, the skill set, the leadership, the sponsorship, everything. Yeah. Everything was new to me.
How did you figure out after 2 years, I'm ready to take it full time?
I love it. Yeah. You know, Antarctica opened up another set of horizon for me. It's like being out in the middle of nowhere. Again, it's that nature connection. It's like, this is my home.
Mm.
I'd rather be out there than in a concrete city. That feeling, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very strong connection, I would say, a very personal connection. It's like God talking to me out there.
But there's also the reality, right? If you want to do it full time, you must make it into a business of some sort.
Yeah.
Like even Everest must be at least $100,000 to do it, let alone sustain yourself.
Yeah.
How do you figure out the commercial part to make
sponsorship? Yeah, of course, personally, I couldn't afford it.
Mm.
And so I knew sponsorship is the way to go.
Yeah.
And from Everest, we had a good learning.
Yeah.
Yeah, good experience. We learned how to pitch to potential sponsors. We know how to approach them, how to set up a unique angle.
Mm.
Yeah. It's basically a marketing pitch.
Yeah.
Right? What is the product? What is it so unique?
Yeah.
And why would sponsor part with their money to you, you know? I'm not a marketeer. I'm a mountain climber, you know. So I had to learn all that, but I embraced it all.
Yeah.
And I knew the road A to B is not straight line. That's how you learn.
So what was your pitch? What's your value proposition then?
I think the Everest one was easy, being the first, you know, Singapore team.
Yeah.
And then Antarctica is also very obvious.
First
Singapore team to the South Pole and so forth. And the seventh summit was a bigger one. The first Southeast Asian, because no one has done it, not just Singaporean. Mm. And I found lucky to end at that time.
Yes.
Yeah, very timely. They came to Asia and they needed a story. So sponsorship is not just a donation. People think it's just asking for donation. It's far from it. It's a business proposition. It's contracts are involved.
Yeah.
You have to sign on the dotted line. It's work. Basically, and I have to learn how to, you know, sell myself, and then I have to deliver the product.
You can't deliver promises of success, though.
Ah, I've also learned that the trust between me and the sponsor is so important.
Yeah.
So there's always a clause in our contract that says Mr. Koo can never promise success.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sponsors understand because it's a high-risk venture.
Mm.
Right. So that trust sponsors have with me is that I will do my best, but you know, beyond that, if that's too risky, then I have to pull back. It's like business. You have to trust somebody. Yeah. And that people don't quite understand, I think.
Yeah.
People think is once you sign on the line, it's done deal.
How do you build trust then?
Basically, you meet with your sponsors.
Yeah.
And then you tell your story and you lay out your plan.
Mm-hmm. Really
what
working.
You want to do, what's your training plan? And more importantly, what's your emergency plan if something goes wrong?
Mm.
So you assure your sponsors that you're not going to go out there and die. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah.
So through that process, you build the trust. And looking back, it is really human connection.
Is it at the back of your head the fact that, yes, you have already told them, I will not promise success, but if I fail this time, all the other sponsors and potential sponsors will know, and if I do it over and over again?
Yeah, that is that risk, but there's no other way around it, right? Again, that's why my motto is dare to dream.
Yeah.
Dare is the big word. You have to take risks. You know, you do all you can to prepare, to train, to cover all your ground. There will come a time you have to execute. And I have failed many times. People know, you know, it's in the newspaper and all that. But it's part of the learning journey. There's nothing to hide. You know, that transparency, being genuine. And that's how you garner trust. Right? If you're not genuine, people will not trust you. When sponsors see this is Mr. Koo, he's going to do what he says. And if he doesn't succeed, he'll come back alive and try again.
Yeah.
That to me is very precious, that the commercial trust.
But that emergency contingency plan, sometimes you just can't have it. Like for instance, up there, I remember we just did base camp and some of our friends really were suffering. It was really, really, really bad.
They were
physically convulsing as well. And we were told, it's dark. You can't get out of here. You just have to hope you survive through the next day, and the helicopter hopefully can come if the weather is clear.
There is risk, but there are ways to minimize the risk, and then the rest you just pray.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I find that process exciting.
Yeah. We can't talk about your particular kind of risk about talking about death. That's the first thing that will come to people's minds as well. When was the first time you confronted that? And then, did it make you rethink about what you mean?
My first time, it was the training for the South Pole.
Mm.
Greenland, there was a storm and we were stuck for like, I think 8 days or 5 days. and we were stuck in the snow cave, and the wall of the snow cave was coming in slowly. We were like being buried alive, oh, the feeling. Goodness. And we ran out of oxygen. Our stove couldn't start. That was scary. That was scary. Looking back, the way we survived that was we didn't panic. We kind of held our ground. We pray and then we waited. Yeah, we did all we could inside the cave, and then the storm stopped and we came out alive.
This is something you talk about a lot, staying calm or you die.
Yep. There's no choice. If you panic, you die.
Is there a trick to staying calm?
No. There's no trick. You can't teach this. You just got to go and experience it, and hopefully you come back alive and you learn it, and then you become stronger and you become better.
But the thing is, it didn't stop you from continuing. Why is that?
I love what I do. I feel alive when I'm out there.
Yeah.
And so I don't stop. I keep going. And these days I spend a lot of time bringing people. Yeah. That's another story altogether, you know, being responsible and all that. But that still gave me the chance to go out there and being in the mountains.
What's that feeling like when you found yourself drifting to Taiwan?
Oh, that is another scary one. Yeah. That was the last day of the Philippine kayaking traverse. We were traversing from the southern tip to the northern tip of Philippines, 3,000 kilometer. And it was day 87, I remember. We were in a hurry to finish, and the media team was waiting at the finish line. But we knew it was quite a windy day. So me and my partner discussed and said, okay, let's give it a try. And on hindsight, that's a mistake. You should have waited. Anyway, as soon as we got out of the lagoon, we faced the full force of the wind. And then very soon I capsized, and my friend also capsized. Strangely, he drifted inland and I drifted out into the open sea. And I didn't realize until I look at my GPS, it's like, gee, I'm going to Taiwan. But panic. I have my cell phone. I call my sport team. It was quite scary to hear what they say. I said, please come and help me, you know, get me, I'm in trouble. And then I think a few minutes later, they replied, nobody is coming. Yeah, that message got me. It's like, wow, I'm all by myself. Somehow I stayed calm. My whole kayak was submerged already. I couldn't bail water, and I was just holding on. And looking at my GPS, it was quite a fast current. I was at the end of my wits and thinking, what's next? And lo and behold, the fisherman boat came. I waved frantically, you know, please help me. And they had to rescue me. Looking back, I believe in angels. Yeah, I believe somebody up there had been looking after me, you know, again and again.
My lesson is to never rush. I'll let your ego take.
I learned my lessons, yeah. But again, it's that spiritual experience that somebody carry you back safely. Very strong feeling.
Is there a particular part of nature that you feel most connected with? Whether it's the mountains, ice, water?
No, it's just the full force of Mother Nature, you know.
When you decide to quit, you also have family as well.
Yeah.
How did that conversation
go? At that time, when I quit my job, we didn't have children yet.
Yes.
And my wife was very supportive. She's a climber also, kayaking. So she understood my motivation and my feeling at that time, wanting to venture out. So yeah, she said, just go and do it.
I'm sure you were planning as well. So it wasn't as though I'm going to quit to do this. It's a quit, but I have these things in place.
Yeah, at that time, I was already starting to do motivational talks.
Yeah.
And corporates were engaging me.
Yeah.
So that was one stream of revenue. So yeah, it was one step at a time. Yeah. And then the sponsorship to continue the expeditions.
And then also training other people as well.
Oh, the guiding came much later. Mm. Yeah, the guiding and the commercial trips.
Hey Simis, if you haven't done so already, please do head over to give a rating and review for this podcast, because without it, Apple Podcasts, Spotify would never push it forward to let anyone else see. So just head over, share with people, that people will know about this special series, especially the ones that we are showcasing right now on Singaporeans who have achieved incredible success. So the more of these big achievements you make, the more valuable your brand became.
Yeah, I call it work.
Yeah.
You know, my work is sponsorship. So I have to deal with media and PR, branding, products and all that.
What's the trickiest part of dealing with media? Because that can be a double-edged sword.
Actually, I'm an introvert, you know. Given the choice, I would be rather in the mountain alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is work. So I learned to talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned to, you know, do PR and all that.
You forced yourself? Like, how
yeah.
to do it?
Yeah. It's not easy at first. I mean, being an introvert, doing a motivational talk is scary, right?
Yeah.
And I knew this is part of that process to, you know, achieve my dreams, to climb big mountains. This is another message that I always tell people, you know, you have to adapt. Mm-hmm. One door closed, another door open.
Did you have a hit list of everything you wanted to do, which clearly wasn't just mountains?
My list is very long.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You never finish in this lifetime. I would love to cross the Sahara Desert.
How did you figure out what to do in each year, though? Like, the following year, you were doing the Tibet Shishaking Ma without oxygen.
Yeah, sometimes I have a dream,
yeah.
and then I will pitch it to the sponsors. Sometimes it's the other way around. The sponsors have an idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then so you walk around. It's the same with my guiding trip. Sometimes I want to go to a new place, so I open it and then people join. But sometimes there's a group of people who say, I want to go to this place.
Yeah.
Can you bring me there? Yeah, it works both ways.
You've done Everest 3 times.
I think enough.
Enough already.
Yeah.
But K2 you will never do again.
No. K2 is very risky.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just very concerned now because K2, as you know, it's become like Everest. So this year, hundreds of people submitted. You know, having 100 people submitted does not make it less risky.
Mm.
Because there are certain sections like the bottleneck and the traverse, you are just counting on your luck. Because if the huge serac comes down, hundreds of people are going to die.
Yeah.
There's no way to run. So I just hope that they will not come.
Yeah.
You know, because in the past, K2 is just very few people. If something happened, very few casualties. But now you have hundreds of people in one line like Everest, it is a lot deadlier than Everest. K2 is amazing mountain. So I'm very lucky to, you know, that was my first time to Pakistan, first attempt, and I got to the top.
Thank God.
So, thank you God. I'm not going back there again. Yeah.
People don't realize that it's a lot more technically difficult compared to Everest. Well.
Yeah, it's a lot more objective danger, rock fall, you know, the seracs, and just steep. There's no place to rest.
Yeah.
It's almost like a pyramid. Very majestic, very awesome.
What about Tibet's Shishapeng Ma? How's that?
You're not going to let me go on that, huh?
No.
Yeah, that recent accident.
Yes.
Yeah, the 4 people that died make me realize that, again, I was very, very lucky on Shishapeng Ma when I climbed it in year 2001. I was younger and I did it without oxygen. So that was a bit like, you know, the challenge. And we actually climbed without Sherpas.
Wow.
Yeah, and luckily we had another team that had Sherpa. So we kind of, you know, used what they set up. Quite radical. And we climbed the British route, so it was quite steep.
Yeah. But why though? Is it because you wanted the challenge?
Yeah.
Deliberate choice.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, can I do it? Yeah. So anyway, we went. Just me and my American friend. There were like 6 of us to start with. But in the end, on the summit push, it was just me and Chris. You know, me and my friend. Many parts of that route has no fixed rope. We are climbing alpine style, almost like free solo on that steep route. We got to the top very late. It's like 3 p.m. Mm. 3 p.m. is way past the safety zone. You should have turned back like maybe 10 a.m. But we kept going.
Yeah.
And by the time we started to come down, it was sunset and then nightfall, and we were still coming down. And that was when things started to happen. I was starting to hallucinate. Of course, there's no more water, no more food. Your body is just dying.
Yes.
You know, dehydrated. I started to talk to, I thought my friend was there, but literally there's no one there. Yeah, and my friend was further down. So luckily, I was able to kind of hold everything together and again, not panic, slowly down one step at a time. And there was no rope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In pitch dark.
In pitch darkness. That's not the end of the story. So we came back to the high camp and we were very tired, right? It's a snow cave. So we sat down and rest for a while and then we looked around. Something was missing. Our sleeping bag was missing. Our food was missing. And we look around and there's no one there. And we knew we were the last one on the mountain. There's no one there else, you know. There's no storm, there's no wind. So what happened? Up to today, it's still a mystery. The only explanation I have is the year before, in year 2000, there was a huge avalanche and two American climbers died. And one of them was very famous, Alex Lowy. So I figured they were hungry and they were cold. So they took our sleeping bag and our food. So Tibet is a very mysterious and deeply spiritual place.
Never again.
Never again. And now, just like a few weeks ago, you know, the huge accident that killed the two American ladies and the two Sherpas. To me, it's like, wow, Shisha Pengma, you know, called again. Very scary.
Very scary. Wow. That concept of pushing even though you shouldn't push, do you think that was summit fever?
Definitely. I mean, if you read the story of the two ladies, they were competing fiercely to be the first American lady to finish the 14. And with that fierce competition, they ignore the danger signs. I saw that video and it was very windy. On a windy day, that's when avalanche risk is even higher. Yeah. So they shouldn't have crossed that slope. So competition in the mountain is very unhealthy.
Mm, but it exists, yeah, though.
Yeah, everything goes wrong once you have competition in the mountain. Yeah, they should not do that.
And I imagine they're also doing because they want the attention, then they get more prestige.
Yep, it's all part of the game, sponsorship, anyway. You know.
Yeah. But then I suppose there is that group of people who would go, some of these mountaineers are always seeking and hogging attention. I believe we've dealt with that before, right? And they go, you don't love the mountain for the mountain itself. How do you think through that?
Yeah, I did the same thing. Because if you want to do sponsorship, you have to have that. Nowadays with the social media. But you got to have that healthy respect for mountain. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to get to the top today, no matter what happens. And that's when you go wrong. Unfortunately, I've seen many young climbers like that. Yeah. I wish them well.
Yeah.
I wish they will learn to respect the mountain more.
I want to talk about Altitude X with Eurasia X.
Yes.
How did that whole idea come about?
Yeah, it was just a crazy idea. I got to know Azran at that time,
yeah.
CEO of Asia X.
Before.
You know him?
Yeah, I've interviewed him before.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay, okay. Yes, he's right. Such a nice guy. So I just casually pitched to him the idea that I will climb the highest mountain or where you fly to. And he said, okay.
Because he's into fitness as well.
Just like that. And then off we went. It was a very casual conversation and then it turned into a sponsorship. And he's a risk taker. And of course, he has done his homework and he must have researched about me. He said, okay, let's do it. I was very surprised as well. And that's when I went back to climbing the third time from Tibet. That was a special because I have not climbed from Tibet. Mm. First two times was from Nepal.
Is it very different?
It's colder and it's a bit more technical with the rock and all that. Mm. Your base camp is very high. Your so-called ABC Advanced Base Camp is almost as high as Camp 2. 6,004. So imagine spending 1 month at 6,004. Your body doesn't really get to rest. The Tibet side of Everest is really wild. Yeah, there's no tea house, nothing. So you get that wild feeling. However, on that summit day, my eyes got into trouble. And because of the windburn and all that, I was almost blind. It was, again, very scary moment. I thought I was going to die. Unfortunately, my Sherpa was very impatient. After following me for, you know, I don't know how many hours, I got to the top, but I couldn't see. It was all blurred. And on the way down, he basically left me. And if you know the route on the north side, there are a few vertical sections where you have to climb the ladders and all that. It was so scary. Yeah. So scary, I was alone. So I was climbing down all these vertical sections until I got to about quite flat. He waited for me there. Yeah, so it was quite a lesson. Mm. So I learned that I have to trust myself.
Yeah,
especially on the 8,000 meter peaks. Luckily, my eyesight kind of regained a bit of vision. And then when I came down to Camp 3, it was okay. But that episode was very scary. Can you imagine climbing Everest blind?
most people wouldn't have gone to 6,400 meters. What is it like being at that altitude? Because everything changes.
Because of lack of oxygen, your whole system slows down. Your digestion, your breathing. Like, for example, if you get a cut, right, it takes a long time to heal because there's just not enough oxygen. So you got to be very careful. Basically, your whole body is under stress. You're spending a lot of time up there, so long. You lose muscles mass, not just fat. It's kind of like your body is eating up its own self. So you come back skinny.
So there's only an X number of time you can spend there, physically.
Yeah, because we are not meant to live in a high altitude. There's so little oxygen.
How do you decide on all the different adventures that you also went on?
There was one period of time, 2003 and 2008, I didn't climb.
Yeah.
So I went cycling, I went swimming, went kayaking, went skating.
Because you wanted a break.
Yes, I wanted a break from the mountain and I also wanted to explore other things.
Yeah.
And I love it because I love this concept of journey, traveling long distance from one point to another. And for me, it has to be sports, using your own body strength. So I learned how to skate. I was not a skater. I learned how to kayak. I learned how to swim.
And bearing in mind, you first submitted Everest 1998, when you were 33. So this is way past 30, isn't it?
Yep.
You're still picking up new skills.
Yeah, and that's precisely the point.
Yeah.
In endurance sports, you can go very far. You can go very long. I'm almost 60.
Yeah.
Next year.
And
I'm thinking of what to do next year. To celebrate my 60. Endurance sports, there's no hurry.
Yeah.
It's all about stamina and endurance, and of course some strength. Actually, this is the message I want to give to so-called old people. Mm. People say, 40, you're old. No. These days, you can live very long and it's all about lifestyle.
Yeah.
And being active is so important.
And the right training.
Yeah. And, enjoy life. Don't say you're old.
So if someone was in their 30s, their 40s, they want to start getting into one of these things that you're doing, what is your advice for them?
Go do it. Don't wait. Yeah, you never know what happened tomorrow, right?
What about the training? Because there's so much information on it, right?
These days it's much easier. Mm. With YouTube, you can learn anything, right?
Yes.
It makes it easier. But you need to be more selective because there's so many things to do. Pick one or two sports that you love, learn and become good at it. And then you will enjoy it.
Do you find the way that you hike differs once you started leading expeditions? Your relationship with the mountain, because now you can't just go.
Yeah. It's different now because I'm taking a group, so I am responsible for their safety. That's most important. I've seen so many accidents in the mountains. So when I take people, I'm very aware that they have a family waiting for them. So my most important goal is to bring people home safely first. And then I'll bring you to the summit if everything permits. You know, your condition, your body, the weather. If you ask me what's my biggest achievement, I can tell you the thing that I'm most proud of is after guiding for so many years, I've brought everybody home.
Mm.
Yeah, that's something that I am proud of. Not just the summit. And I think also the reason why they want to join my team, they know them home. And they trust me for that. Safety is very important. Because I've lost too many friends in the mountain. I have a list in my phone of people that are no longer with me. Friends that have taken too much risk. I learned from each of their case. And it could have been prevented.
What were some of the lessons you learned that we haven't covered?
Well, we covered a lot. Well, it's hard for me to say to you, the summit is not so important.
Yeah.
Right?
It's until hard for me to say.
Until you do it. Yeah.
Yes.
Then you realize, your life is a lot more precious.
It's like the way people always say, the journey is more important than the destination.
Yeah. But if I tell somebody who's young that, they won't listen.
Yeah.
Right?
I looked at my Everest journey and I go, actually, the journey was more important. Because that's what you remember. The summit was like a little bit, 10 minutes, and then you're gone. Yeah.
I wish everyone knows this, and then they will enjoy more mountains.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that is one of the most important lessons. The other thing is don't take shortcuts. So put in your training, put in your research, read up all you can. And these days, a lot of information, not just about the mountain, read up about the people that are taking you, the Sherpas, You know, are there experience, things like that? The company that you're joining, is it the reputable company, for example, right? Make sure you get your insurance. Make sure it includes helicopter evacuation, things like that. And also, like, if you go Nepal, you're almost going to go above 4,000 meters. So make sure you have, or your guide has emergency oxygen. Things like that are very important details.
And since you mentioned Sherpas, they are very important. There's always controversy around them.
Yep. Sherpas are human.
Yeah.
They are experienced one. They are not so experienced one. So it's really up to you to select the good ones, the experienced one, and people who you can trust. I've seen so many.
Yeah.
Good ones, not so good ones. Yeah. So basically you have to look after yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and equip yourself with the necessary skills before you go out.
And speaking of looking after yourself, as you said, you're almost hitting 60.
Yeah, next year. What should I do?
What should you do? But obviously, there is the whole physical aspect as well. You can't keep hiking.
Yeah,
if you wanted to.
Yeah, there will come a time I'm very aware that I know my legs will give way, my lungs will give way.
How do you think about that? Because you don't want it to give way when you're up there.
I don't think about it a lot. I mean, people ask me, right, why do you keep pushing yourself? My motivation is very simple. I know there will come a day when I cannot climb. So I better climb while I can. Very simple.
Yeah. Anything still on your list that you haven't ticked off?
There are many mountains I would love to climb, many countries which I would love to travel to. Mm. You know, South America, there are many countries. Africa, there are many countries I've not been. There are beautiful mountains there as well. You've never finished. I need another life.
So in terms of a second act, what will happen after that? Do you think about it? Because some of my previous guests, they say, we do think about it. We plan 10, 15 years before.
I don't.
You don't?
Yeah, I don't seriously think about it. Who knows what will happen tomorrow?
Yeah.
You know? So I'm just making the most of what I have now.
Yeah.
And that's enough to keep me going. Even though I've written 5 books, I'm actually looking for inspiration to write the next book. Yeah. Let me know. No, I don't have a long-term plan, if that's what you mean.
Yeah. Is there anything that listeners can help you with?
Oh, well, ideas are welcome. Yeah.
Before we end, I actually have 2 questions submitted from listeners that I would like to play for you. So here's the first one from Vimala Thangavelu.
Hi, Sweet Chill. I'm Vimala Thangavelu. And I find your commitment to pushing yourself to your mental and physical limits absolutely fascinating. And I think there's so much we can learn from you to apply in our careers and our leadership journey. So my question for you is, as a leader in extreme environments, which leadership principles have proven most effective in guiding your teams through adversity? Thank you.
Leadership example. You know, leadership is a word that is overused. Okay, to me, I think being genuine is important. I bring people to the mountain, so I'm genuinely concerned for their safety, for their enjoyment, you know, for their comfort. Just to give an example, there have been a few cases where they wanted to push on, but they got AMS. And sometimes when you have AMS, you can't think straight, right? Normally, when things are okay, my style is I let everybody do their own thing. You know, I don't tell you what to do because it's an adventure. You want to have fun. As long as you don't get into danger, it's fine. However, when you are sick and your life is in danger, that's when I will come in and say, no, you have to go down. And I've done it a few times. So I think being a leader is you have to be firm. You have to make difficult decisions. When you know it's difficult, when you know it's not popular, but you know it's the right thing to do. I find that very important. Yeah, and again, many times I have to do that. And after people go home, they tell me they appreciate it because they are alive. Yeah.
Second question from Regina.
Hi, Sichao. My name is Regina. I'm a financial planner who advocates holistic planning. My question to you is, I wonder what drives you to push your limit to the extreme each time, and how do you reconcile the fact that each climb can potentially be your last? Thank you.
Well, like I said before, my motivation these days is very simple. The sand in my hourglass is finishing. I do not know how many more years I have, so I'm just enjoying it and making full use of what I have now. While I still can, while my legs are still allowing me to climb, I'm very aware that one day I cannot climb again. So I just keep going. I don't worry about it being the last, or could it be the last expedition. So again, that goes back to the risk-taking, the risk assessment, the preparations. The risk is there, so you do your best to minimize the risk, but then you will have to go and climb the mountain. Yeah.
Sichao, it's been such a pleasure to have had you on. I always end with the same questions. So the first is this. Do you feel like you have found your why?
Wow. Yes and no. My favorite song is U2. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. But I'm contented because I enjoy what I do. Yeah. People talk about what's the meaning of life and purpose. I don't think I will find it in this life. When I see God, I will ask Him. But I think it's important to just find the little thing that you enjoy and do it well. And to me, it's the mountain, it's the adventure. And now the why is the connection, is the passing on to people around me. Yeah.
What kind of legacy do you want to leave behind?
I don't think about it. I let people decide. So my legacy is letting people appreciate the Mother Nature, letting people test their own limit in a safe way and so forth. Maybe encouraging people to dare to dream, to chase their own dream.
And yeah. What do you think are the most important qualities of a successful person?
Wow. Leadership again. Be yourself. I think you cannot be who you are not. You have to find yourself in this noisy world and finding your path.
So if people ask, who are you, how do you introduce yourself or describe yourself?
Adventurer. Life is an adventure. Just go out there and find your own path.
And where can people go to find out about what you're doing?
Okay. I'm on Facebook and IG. I post my trips and the schedules and pictures and all that on Facebook and IG. And also, people who have been on my trips, you know, they will come back and do a few more trips. So I think word of mouth is the best.
And that was the end of episode 143 of the So This My Why podcast. The show notes and transcript can be found at sothismywhy.com/143. And if you want to know more about what's happening on this podcast, the behind the scenes, and also how you can brand yourself online, just head over to sothismywhy.com or just drop me a DM on any of my platforms, including my name, Ling Ya, on LinkedIn. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, and I'll see you next Sunday with